There's so many tangents to follow. You know, sometimes it's hard to know. Sometimes these tangents run parallel. It's hard to know who's really in charge, right? And which one is the leading one? One that I follow I'm exposing my recent book is a really strange one. First of all, if you look at how basically Kabbalah infiltrated and corrupted Christianity is typically with the worship of the Virgin Mary, and that goes all the way back to the Templars. And the Virgin Mary is basically a Christian version of the Shekinah, which is the divine feminine in Kabbalah. So this becomes really important under Jacob Frank. And Jacob Frank is Shabbatai Zvi's main successor, who came on the scene about 100 years after Shabbatai Zvi. And basically his mission was centered around the worship of the Virgin Mary, particularly the Black Madonna in Poland. He spent several years. In fact, he was basically imprisoned, and he was imprisoned in the monastery that held the Black Madonna. So the Black Madonna is the black goddess. It's like the black goddess, basically meaning sort of the reverse, the basically an evil goddess. This is an idea that goes back, you know, thousands of years. Because this idea of the goddess and the Shekinah goes back to the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. And Song of Solomon is basically a discussion between the lover and the beloved. And it's supposed to represent the sort of sacred, basically sexual relationship between the two counterparts. And one of them in Song of Songs, she declares herself as, "I am black, but I am beautiful." And this is basically the basis of the black goddess. So to most Christians, it's perceived to be some kind of a miraculous phenomenon. But esoterically, it's understood that this is really ultimately the black goddess that they're worshiping.
And you'll find this in almost any Jesuit cathedral. I know I've seen them. I've got pictures of the Black Madonna sitting there inside of a Jesuit cathedral.
Right. So there's an amazing website by a guy who calls himself a Jewish Christian. And he has put together a detailed genealogy of the followers of Jacob Frank and where they ended up, how they infiltrated Christianity, the various families that a lot of them are names that most of us have never heard of. They played minor roles here and there. But what's particularly interesting is the several popes that he traces that are originally Sabbateans. And I can't remember which ones, but there's two of them, the two pious popes in the turn of the century. So what happens is that most people hopefully have heard about the Alta Vendita. This is the so Giuseppe Mazzini came up with a plot that they were going to infiltrate Christianity and ultimately install a pope. And the advisor that was working with the pope at the time is Cardinal Rampolla. And so Cardinal Rampolla is listed in the OTO as one of their members. And what's interesting is Cardinal Rampolla was destined or basically effectively chosen to become pope, but there was some obscure ruling that right at the last minute they came up with to bar his election to pope. So that initial attempt failed, but this basically seems like the Masons continued to sort of stream into the Catholic Church.
And so let's just jump back a second.
Yeah.
Okay. So Jacob Frank.
Yeah.
We're looking at this
1750s.
Just prior to that, in 1666, we have this rise of Sabbateism.
Right.
And this plays in a huge role of then making the Zionists, the Jews who are not Jews. These were right. occult Jews that now we should call something else. And, you know, maybe...
Absolutely. Heretics.
Heretics. I've heard Shelonites, Canaanites, right. you know, so that you're not caught in that anti-Semitic trap. Because right. these... We're talking about, you know, most people don't know what a Sabbatean is.
No, they don't exactly. And they basically hijacked. They've hijacked Judaism, and they managed to create a state, which they call a Jewish state and called Israel, and it has nothing to do with Judaism.
And that really was their coupling with Turkey and Germany, and were basically. All the German Jews were sent off to Israel to really found and form the Israeli state, right?
Yeah, they were basically used as fodder. They, of course, some you know, thousands if not millions of them were exterminated in the concentration camps. So, you know, the irony there is that we will probably get to this point later, but they've deliberately used the protocols and they completely to they deliberately, and this is. When we get to the point of Trump, they deliberately use the concept of a Jewish conspiracy to create a right-wing movement. You know, today it's Trump. 50 years ago, it was Hitler. And
there's Hitler's a lot of case, similarities.
Well, there's more than it sounds like, right? But it's a little deeper than that. But okay. Yes, it's the same. I talked about it with my, you know, in the interview with, on Nazi media, but it's the same group who have survived post, you know, post-Nazism in the United States. In fact, they were here in the United States before the rise of the Nazis. And that same group has been working behind the scenes to hijack the Republican Party, and their first successful candidate is Donald Trump.
That's crazy. So the Sabbateans utilized lodges like the Freemasonic Order, yeah. infiltrated, also coupled with Adam Weishaupt bringing forward the Illuminati, which then infiltrated deeper into Freemasonry, and then altered the whole scope of everything so that we now have the America of today.
Yes, the Masonic state of the United States.
Right. And this would explain more of why people, when they talk of the Illuminati, they show the eye in the pyramid symbolism, which, yeah. of course, Adam Weishaupt's Illuminati never used, but no, Freemasonry yeah. does, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so we're starting to get to who the they are, and then also the social engineering of burning down Notre Dame and bringing this Chrislam crisis coming together. These yeah. are kind of the directions that I'm hoping we're going to go today.
Yeah. So the point I'd like to get to is Vatican II. And that's really the, so that's, Vatican II is the first major success. So what happens is that these cardinals are, the popes, the pious popes, they were the ones who were principally responsible for the real push of what they call Mariology, right? The worship of the Virgin Mary. And, so these are the guys, those are the popes that really sort of, you know, brought it to the fore in most recent times. And they were also affiliated with a secret society called, this is a French secret society called the Hierons de Val d'Or. And so this was the group that inspired the Priory of Zion myth. So the Priory of Zion, it's been made very popular by Dan Brown. It was originally popularized by the Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Holy Grail, yeah.
And those guys were basically duped and manipulated. It was an elaborate hoax that was developed by a guy named Pierre Plantard. But another important book is The Zion Revelation by Picknett and Price. And that book shows that, so even though it's a hoax, it's a what they call a ludibrium. It's a serious hoax. It's a serious joke. It's a joke that's got a lot of meaning to it.
Left Plantard as a direct descendant of Jesus.
Well, that's the... That's
in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail myth. Yeah.
So that's what they created, exactly. So as far-fetched as that is, there's a whole... It was concocted by people who were deeply instructed in occult history, who really understood the... who had deep knowledge of the occult history. So it's a modification of a true history. And so this Hierono Valdor at the turn of the century, also affiliated with it, is René Guénon. And René Guénon is, you know, the principal godfather of what they call traditionalism now, or ultimately is the synarchist tradition. That's another trajectory that leads to Julius Evola and ultimately today, Alexander Dugin, who's the architect of the Russian campaign to back Trump. And so what it goes back to is that, again, this is the Marian tradition in the Catholic Church. And the most important event at this time is the Secrets of Fatima. So in 1914, I think it was, I can't remember the year exactly, these three orphan children witness a visitation of supposedly the Virgin Mary, and she makes all kinds of prophecies, and she, and eventually one of the sisters grows up and reveals some of the secrets, but withholds the third secret.
Right.
And the
if I remember correctly, sorry to interrupt, but I think that was a September 11 event. It was either September 11 or 10/13. I'm going to have to look that up. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt my brain.
There's many interpretations, but the key point is that the third secret involves the consecration of Russia. And this is what that's where Alexander Dugin's role comes in. And again, the whole role of synarchism. So now to back up, back to Vatican II, the chief architect and the Zionist agent who was involved in serving Sabbatian Zionist interests within the church was Malachi Martin. If you're familiar with him.
All right. So we had the prophecy of Malachi Martin that led to the final pope.
Right. So Malachi Martin is basically a Zionist agent and an occultist. He is friends with, I forgot his name now. You know, this is the first time, this book this time is so huge. There's more facts than I can hold in my head.
Well, that's what books are for. We're just here to promote your book so that people will read it. You know, you don't have to remember every detail. I love Jordan Maxwell when he says, yeah, I've forgotten more than you'll ever know. That way, don't you?
That's right.
So to be clear, Fatima was a 10/13 event. These are something, I have an annual 10/13 show, and you know, it's one of the significant dates that I have found. Of course, 10/13 becoming the most, the brain, where did it go? Notorious day being Friday the 13th in 1307 was the day the Templar came down. So Fatima fell on that same holiday of this order as well. So just... Yeah,
that's good to keep in mind. So Malachi Martin, Zionist agent. I have the details in my book. I can't remember the people he's working with and communicating, but it's pretty out. It's the evidence is there. And so what they did, and that's what it is. Malachi Martin's friend, Kumaraswamy, is his friend. And so with Vatican II, what he said is that basically, the initial effort that failed with Cardinal Rampolla had finally succeeded. So Cardinal Rampolla, the cardinal that belonged to the OTO, who they tried to install as Pope, had failed. But now with Vatican II, they had finally succeeded. So Vatican II really represents, I mean, you know, like what do they call it? The Novus or the Novus Mass or whatever it is. It's like, the Vatican II is so replete with Masonic symbolism, it's ridiculous.
Tell me more about the Vatican II.
Yeah, so Vatican II is basically the major Vatican, what do you call it? Like a what's the word for it? Like a major, like it's, you know, the entire Catholic Church, leaders of the Catholic Church decide to get together and to, you know, discuss the fundamentals of the church and how to interpret them or reinterpret them. So basically they created what's called the new mass. And I can't remember what's the Latin word for it. It's something like Novus Ordo Seclorum, but not exactly Novus Ordo Missae or something like that.
So when the Jesuits and the Pope are coming out saying ET are our space brothers, then that's the kind of thing they'll be discussing at Vatican II. I'm just saying, yeah, that was one of the stranger comments to come out of the Pope, but go on, please. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So Vatican II was Kumaraswamy is who is he? He was the son of one of the major figures in traditionalism who worked very closely with René Guénon. So this is why this synarchist tradition is the underlying thread here. And the secrets of Fatima, the underlying basis of the synarchist aspirations in our time, along with the prophecies of Nostradamus.
And so
when you look at Nostradamus as well, Nostradamus was actually born a Jew and converted or whatever. So, you know, the tradition here is that this is a mystical tradition of visitations. And this is what the whole point is.
This is what synarchism is?
This is what occult, this is what mysticism is. Today it's called synarchism, but that's what it is. So when you go back to the first centuries, at least the third century BC, that's when it starts. And that's where the birthplace of the Kabbalah starts with revelations, or what used to be called in those days apocalypses or apocalyptic literature, which was literature that was dictated from some divine being who had imparted their knowledge from beyond. And those apparitions usually take on holy names, like they'll impersonate, you know, Zoroaster, or they'll impersonate Abraham or Enoch or John or John of Revelation. So that's why the book Revelation is understood to be such a mystical text. So these guys have always been operating by communicating with spirits who impart them the knowledge from beyond, which then they use to carry out or advance their missions. And so that's what synarchism means. Synarchism is a system, and in fact, as a political system, synarchism is supposed to be run by priests who are in contact with the beyond, and who receive the communication and then pass it back to the rulers and politicians, who then do the dirty work. So, the higher ups of the secret societies are, you know, or sort of the more noble, who had the noble task of keeping in contact with the quote unquote gods. So that's why the Secrets of Fatima, Nostradamus, is basically just a continuation of this mystical tradition of receiving communications from spirits.
Which essentially seems to be leading to the apocalypse. I mean, we're talking about the last pope, we're talking about the secret hidden message in Fatima, which...
Right.
Do we have understanding of what that was?
Yep. So there's a multiple of them, right? So yes. So the Book of Revelation is the blueprint. It took me so long to figure that out. And the crazy thing is that it's practically the first thing that's stated in Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma.
Hmm.
So, you know, for a long time, I started to have a suspicion that, you know, people think that certain prophecies, quote unquote prophecies in the Book of Revelation are coming true. Like the RFID chip at the wrist and the forehead, that kind of stuff.
Right.
That's not a coincidence.
Right.
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So what I started to recognize is that a lot of these mystics were studying the Book of Revelation. In fact, it's not just Revelation. It's also Daniel is very important. Like Newton was obsessed with Daniel. So where was I? So yeah, Book of Revelation. So
we're looking at the synarchist plan.
So, right. So the Book of Revelation is the last book to have been accepted into the New Testament canon. It wasn't accepted until the 4th century AD. And after a lot of debate, there was a lot of very reputable Christian fathers who rejected it. And it's only near the year 400 or so that it finally was accepted as part of the New Testament canon. But there's still people who were opposed to it. And the problem is that there was this rumor that the Book of Revelation was actually authored by a Gnostic named Corinthus.
It's very esoteric.
So the funny thing is that this is exactly what Albert Pike says. Albert Pike says that the Book of Revelation was written by Corinthus. And that he says, like, right out in the open, and he says it in the, you know, I think it's pretty close to the opening of the book. He says that the Book of Revelation is a Kabbalistic coded book. And it is basically the blueprint for the what Masons call the Great Work.
Yes.
Right? So the Great Work, the magnum opus of Freemasonry, the craft, is to, you know, the Masons are builders who are building the third temple, which is the fulfillment of the prophecy of the Book of Revelation, because the Messiah can only come when the third temple is completed.
Which is why Notre Dame and the Alaska Mosque fires are so important.
Presumably.
To that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because Alaska Mosque, you know, let me just throw this in there, is some believed by many to turn into this third temple or be the place of.
It's where it needs to be built.
Right.
And this is where Trump is a key character. So Trump is seen today by right-wing Zionists and, of course, their dupes, the right-wing
Antifa.
Evangelical Christians in the United States who voted him in are... Trump is seen by them. They see both Trump and Putin as the Cyrus figures who are going to allow or create the circumstances that will permit the reconstruction of their temple. And first, of course, Alaska has to be destroyed because that's the location. I used to think that Clinton was higher up, especially when you consider that her husband was right in the thick of it in Mena, Arkansas, which was the central hub of the entire Iran-Contra operation.
Yes.
And so, you know,
guns for drugs.
Iran-Contra was the most significant, modern conspiracy that really interlinked all the important players. It was a conspiracy that was designed to raise funds to pay bin Laden in his fight against the Russians. But I was shocked to find out that how this parallel trajectory that brought Trump to power was under the radar all this time.
Yeah.
And so this right-wing history is really, it's a lot of what I was beginning to scratch at in my book called Black Terror, White Soldiers. But it really completes the other half of the story.
I've never seen a nation more divided.
See, that's the thing, right? It's basically that's what it goes back to. It goes back to founding of the United States, right? So if we're talking about the Sabbatian movement was created by the Rosicrucians. And it's not an accident that he declared himself Messiah in 1666 because it was a deliberate fulfillment of the Book of Revelation. And so what happens is that the Rosicrucians basically come on the scene in 1614, 1619, somewhere around there, and they try to elect their candidate as a king, and which... ignites the 30 Years' War. It basically destroys the movement. They all flee. They run to England. They found Freemasons. And a number of them go to Holland and in Leiden in particular. And from there, they jump on the Mayflower and hop across the pond and go and found the several colonies in the United States, particularly the Massachusetts Bay Colony and Salem, Massachusetts, of course, if you can know what that means. Mm-hmm. And so the Mayflower was a Rosicrucian mission. The Puritans were basically a Rosicrucian movement. And when they say they were escaping persecutions, they were Kabbalistic heretics who were looking to practice their occult brand of Christianity more freely in the United States. And that's so
perfectly clear.
Right. So, you know, the sort of separation of church and state, which has been created here as deliberately as a way to provide a haven for Kabbalistic occult, Gnostic variations of religion to rise, you know, unhindered.
Well, let me throw this in for you, folks. The Georgia Guidestones, you know, limit or maintain the population at 500,000. You know, all speak one language, have one religion, all of that. In the Georgia Guidestones, the author of the Georgia Guidestones is R.C. Christian Rosenkreutz is the founder of the Rosicrucian Order, or the mystical brother of So right there, up to the Georgia Guidestones, folks, we are finding this Rosicrucian symbol, marking, and notation.
Yeah, so you have the Rosicrucian founding of America, and then, most importantly, then there are several... I jump ahead, and basically you get the founding of Scottish Rite Freemasonry in Charleston, South Carolina, is it?
Yes. Not too far from here.
Right.
Yes. So that, and they have a creepy Cthulhu on that temple. I'm just letting you know that.
So you have seven Jewish Masons who come to the United States and found the southern jurisdiction of Scottish Rite. And then Albert Pike becomes its leader. And so, first of all, to understand white supremacism in the first place, it's a Kabbalistic idea. It starts in the 1700s in Europe. Mostly scholars who are affiliated with the Illuminati. The only one I can remember off the top of my head is Friedrich Schlegel. What happens is that these scholars discover that there are similarities between Sanskrit. Basically, it's when the British basically take hold of India, then European scholars kind of have free reign to more access to a lot of the Hindu history and literature. And they discover that they believe there's a relationship between Sanskrit and German, in particular, in European languages. So they came up with this hypothesis that there must have been a parent language, which they called Indo-European. And so the funny thing is that this idea is still, the concept still exists today. The concept of a Caucasian people is still accepted today. Most of the exoteric aspect of this story is still popular. What's not known is the occult origin of that idea. And the idea is that it was the Aryans, the Aryans were offspring of the sons of God of the Bible who intermarried with human beings and created the race of the Aryans on Atlantis.
Let's be clear that Aryans aren't blonde-haired, blue-eyed people.
Well, you know, this is all intertwined with two things, the legends of the Lost Tribes and Gog and Magog. Well, I'll get into that. Sorry.
It's just, when you look into theosophy and you see their Aryan race and the root races, you're looking at, Middle Eastern men. You're not looking at blonde-haired, blue-eyed people. And we have so much now confused with our history because of the Nazis that, people hear one thing and they see what's in their mind. So I'm thinking of Mahmoud Makami and all those.
The idea that they're blind and blue-eyed is core to their belief system, right? It's the whole point is that this is supposed to be a semi-divine race who are the carriers of ancient wisdom. So when Atlantis sank, they escaped and landed in the mountains of Asia, particularly the Caucasus Mountains. They spread from there, and they carried with them the ancient wisdom. So this created what they called the Oriental Kabbalah. And what they believed is that these original Aryans, so this was, you know, 100 or more years before Blavatsky developed this idea. This was one of the streams in Scottish Rite Freemasonry, an idea that was disseminated by Swedenborg, Manuel Swedenborg, who happens to have been very cozy with numerous Sabbateans. He was raised by Sabbateans. Am I getting this right? He was affiliated with Count Zinzendorf, who was a Sabbatean as well, too, who was, Swedenborg was a neighbor with Samuel Jacob Falk, Rabbi Falk, who was basically the figure behind late 18th century Freemasonry. So, and a Sabbatean to boot. So, Swedenborg was promoting this idea of an Oriental Kabbalah. And this is the idea that long before the Jews had the Kabbalah, the Aryans were the true origin of Kabbalah that they had planted in the East, particularly in Tibet. And this is where you get ideas like the Kalachak Tantra and so on and so forth.
Okay, another thing I got to throw in here, David, sorry. Nicholas Roark. The very guy who put the pyramid on the dollar bill to convince Henry Wallace to put that on there was paid by the American government to go to Tibet to meet with these people in these subterranean caverns with giant crystals, and he painted it all. And of course, you can see all that, folks, on freemantv.com if you want to check out the paintings of Nicholas Roark and find out why there's a pyramid on the dollar bill. But he was paid to go to this Tibetan, and just to couple with what you're saying as well, just to bring this all again, Albert Pike mentions Kabbalah in Morals and Dogma over 70 times. So we know that this is the force.
It's the underlying doctrine.
Right.
And of course, Nicholas Roark was a synarchist. He was in Tibet at the same time as the Nazis were doing the very same thing.
Right.
And
now we're in Indiana Jonesville.
And he was in regular communication with the Russian Secret Service, basically very synarchist and Martinist within the Russian Secret Service.
Let's throw in that they built him a building in New York City that is designed to channel entities into the attic, like Ghostbusters, right? Like it's called the Master Building. It's there, folks, up in there. It's now an apartment complex, so who lives there? I don't know. So they literally built him a building to channel entities, much like they did at the UN in their meditation room. But I want to back up what you're saying. Like, look, here it is, guys. We're talking about channeling entities using Kabbalistic magic. Here are the players, and learn what a Sabbatean is.
Right.
Yeah.
So if we want to back way back to the 6th century BC, when the Israel or the Israelites were divided into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, the first to have been conquered by the Assyrians was Israel, where the 10 tribes lived. They were expelled, carried out into the land of the Medes, and were then henceforth known as the Lost Tribes. This was all in the territory primarily of Armenia and northern Iran, and many of them spread to, as far as the Caucasus. There's various accounts that they, you know, were brought as far as the Don Valley Basin in southern Russia or Ukraine. And so those people in ancient times were known as Scythians. And then in the 7th or 8th century AD, they converted to Judaism, and they were known as Khazars.
Right.
And they were also believed to have been the descendants of Gog and Magog. And that's where it's really important. So basically, the Aryan race, as paradoxical as this sounds, is an attempt to create an occult version, an occult history of the Khazars and Gog and Magog.
Right. So debasement and debauchery.
Well, yeah. So this, you know, the Aryan race, I mean, frankly speaking, is a bastardization of the chosen people concept. So, you know, the sad irony is that a lot of whites get caught up in the idea and think that it's referring to them, but really it's an occult idea. So fast forward, you know, the idea is that the swastika, which is a popular Indian and Buddhist symbol,
right,
was a marking that was attributed to the wanderings of the ancient Aryans. So it was a symbol that's supposed to indicate the presence, former presence of the Aryan people. And so the first group to use the swastika to identify themselves was a group called the Asiatic Brethren. And the Asiatic Brethren were founded in 1790-something, 80-something, by Jacob Franks, can't remember if it's his cousin or his nephew, his name is Moses Dobrushka. And so the Asiatic Brethren, the name is a reference to this concept in Scottish Rite Freemasonry about what they call the Eastern Mystics. So the core legend of Scottish Rite Freemasonry is that when the Templars were in the Holy Land, they came into contact with these quote-unquote Eastern Mystics. And it's well known that that refers to the Sabians or the Mandaeans, and the two are interchangeable. And this was an occult, non-Muslim society or group, that community that existed inside the Islamic world for years, who were specialists in occult knowledge, particularly Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, astrology. And they were the group primarily responsible for the infiltration of those ideas into the Islamic world. One of the results of that was the creation of the Ismaili group, of which the Aga Khan today is the modern representative. The Assassins. The Aga Khan is the modern-day representative of the Assassins. So the legend has it that when the Templars were in the Holy Land, they got in contact with the Assassins, the Ismailis, Sabians, whatever, and rescued a number of them and brought them to Scotland. And that's how this sacred tradition was introduced into Scotland, and which was perpetuated by the Sinclair family, and then, you know, until, and then eventually into Scottish Rite Freemasonry. So this idea now, the Scottish Rite Freemasons were also now simultaneously the perpetuators of this notion of an Aryan race, which I said basically is Gog and Magog.
Yeah, believe me, folks, the Mason temples are segregated.
Yeah, so they come to the United States, establish Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which then becomes, it's not the sole origin of American racism, but it is one that took over Southern American racism. So, you know, we've seen now with the election of Donald Trump that racism is the fundamental issue in the United States. It's a divide that basically Mason-Dixon line is still fundamentally the fundamental political divide in the United States. And it starts off because it starts off with slavery. So again, you're not going to pick on people, but you know, in the Middle Ages, it was the Jews primarily who dominated the slave trade. And they started first by trading in the Middle East. In fact, what people don't realize is that one of the two industries that they specialized in the Middle Ages, especially in the Dark Ages, was trading European slaves. So people tend to think that blacks, Africans were the only ones who were traded, but Europeans in those days were also traded in various parts of the world. Because at that time, you know, this is before the Crusades, Europe was mired in a dark age. It was basically, you know, they had been completely ravaged and destroyed by the Vikings. There was barely any economy or industry. And so they were people that were easily exploited. And so when Jewish slave traders started to trade Africans, they used... And it wasn't only Jewish slave traders. It was eventually Muslim traders as well as Christian traders. but they used an interpretation, a Talmudic interpretation of the book of Genesis. So if people are familiar with the story, is that after the flood, Noah becomes drunk and passes out, and his son Ham comes in onto him and he laughs. And so Noah pronounces a curse on Ham, but the curse is pronounced for Canaan. And he says, "Cursed be Canaan, and slaves shall you be unto thy brethren," is something approximately along those lines. So the Talmudic interpretation of that verse was used to justify the enslavement of Africans, because the Africans were believed to be descendants of Ham, which doesn't make any sense because the Canaanites ended up in Palestine, not Africa. But that was what they used. And then so the Christians then, you know, I think the important point here is that I think that fundamentally the reason why the United States is unable to face its problem with racism is because it's not facing the true origin of it. It's just assumed that your Southern whites just don't like blacks, and they have a tradition of hating and bigotry. But the truth is that it's rooted in a Christian interpretation where they believe that that their interpretation of the Bible, because they're, you know, fundamentally pious Christians, but they believe that they are commanded according to their interpretation of the Bible to that their enslavement of Africans is the rightful thing to do. And in fact, they, you know, there was many justifications where they actually thought that they were doing blacks a favor, you know, that they were civilized, even though they had to work hard, but they were civilizing, right? So that's the point. And that's the reality that needs to be addressed. And then fundamentally, it's a really, really a sad, sad reality that basically an anachronism was taken to justify the gross enslavement of, you know, basically, and then the rape of millions of people out of Africa. Anyway, so what happens now is you have this entire industry that dominates, that is dependent on the slave trade in the United States, and along comes Albert Pike,
right?
And basically now, what's very interesting here is that there's this whole states' rights movement which comes up, right? So the curious thing about it is that the man who started that is Vice President Calhoun. And he was at Yale. So these guys were actually Northerners who came down and implanted this idea in the South. He was at Yale. It just happens to be that he was at Yale only just years before the Skull and Bones was founded. But the Skull and Bones have memorabilia in their lodges to commemorate Calhoun. And so all the people, so basically, you've got this coalescence now, right around in the period just before the Civil War, of Skull and Bones, Scottish Rite Freemasons, particularly led by Albert Pike, a group called the Knights of the Golden Circle, mm-hmm. and another very curious group is a group called the Mystic Crew of Comus, and so they are the group that organized the Mardi Gras in New Orleans.
The Mystic Group of who?
Comus, C-O-M-U-S. Huh. I think they spell it K. So it's Mystic with a K, Crew with a K, and Comus with a K.
Okay.
So Comus is this is a whole other tangent, but Comus goes all the way back to Shakespeare. And this is what these guys are celebrating. So Shakespeare was actually Francis Bacon. And they started around. So basically, Mardi Gras is the carnival. There are four important occult festivals per year coinciding with the cycle of the sun. So there's Christmas, Easter, St. John's Day, and Halloween. And somewhere in between there is carnival. So I can't give you all eating the details, but to make a long story short, basically Francis Bacon starts, this tradition of screenplays started in what's called the Inns of Court, which was basically, it was founded by the Templars. And they started to celebrate Christmas with these stage plays or performances. And it was headed by what they call the Lord of Misrule. So that's exactly what the Saturnalia is, and that's what it's a modern version of. So Mardi Gras Carnival is the ancient Roman Saturnalia, which goes back to the Babylonian festivals called, I think it's called Zagmuk or something like that. I can't remember exactly.
And that's wrapped up in voodoo.
It's the worship of Saturn, which involved human sacrifice.
Right.
So we got time here. Maybe I'll explain what it is.
Sure. So, yeah, we got a good 10 minutes.
So now if you go back to ancient times, the Israelites were guilty, of, according to the Bible, right? Guilty of passing their children through the fire of Moloch.
Right.
And Moloch is Saturn. So Saturn was worshipped by many people around the ancient Mediterranean, involving human sacrifice. In fact, they used to construct a statue, and they used to put the babies in the hands of the statue, and then the statue had a mechanism in it that would there was a fire inside the statue, and the mechanism would basically lift the child, the infant, and drop it in the mouth of the statue to drop it in the fire inside of the statue. So this is a well-known fact. And so, So what happens is that the king is the embodiment of the Son of God, and so the virility of the king is, or the fertility of the land is dependent on the virility of the king. So if the king was started to become frail, you needed to kill him. So this is called a sacred killing of the king. And what happened is that eventually the king was too valuable, or, you know, he didn't want to get knocked off, so they would have a replacement. So they would have this festival called Carnival, and it was 12 days, corresponding with 12 days of Christmas. And the roles were reversed for 12 days, where the slaves would take on the roles of the masters. The masters would take on the role of the slaves. And it was a big joke where, you know, the slaves could then order their masters to do all kinds of ridiculous things. But then at the end of it, the Lord of Misrule, the impersonator of the king, the king of the carnival. It's in Victor Hugo. It's because that takes place in Victor Hugo and the Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is a whole over this. Anyway, so
which no longer exists.
Right. So there you go. Now we're getting back to that topic, right? This Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's all interconnected. So so this is basically the basis of Shakespeare's plays. So that's why Shakespeare is completely occult. Puck. Midsummer's Day, all that stuff is basically all of cult origin. And so Comus is the original name for is the root name for comedy. It's a Greek, ancient Greek god of, I think, god of like revelry and stuff like that. That is basically Lucifer. And so Comus Comus was actually, it's a mask. I think it was written by Ben Jonson, I think, is the person. So that's where that name comes from, who was a friend of Francis Bacon and Shakespeare and so on and so forth. So that's the origin of the Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras, yeah.
So now these people, so now again, with Skull and Bones, crew of Comus, Knights of Gold and Crew Circle, Albert Pike, who was the Grand Master of the Scottish Rite, a certain jurisdiction, and a guy named Judah P. Benjamin. And he's recognized as being one of the most influential Jews of the pre-Civil War period, as basically an agent of the Rothschilds. So they basically take advantage of the racist sentiments in the South to effectively orchestrate the Civil War. And so that divide still exists to this day. So the most important thing here is that Albert Pike, Judah P. Benjamin, and Albert Pike were both helped in the founding of the Klan. And what does the Klan believe in? Klan is actually an evolution of the Knights of the Golden Circle. They are a they are sort of like, they are also one of these sort of mocking groups, like a joking sort of organization, like a, which again goes back to this carnival tradition that I'm telling you about, and are supposedly a modern variation of the Templars, and their racist, their racism is presumably based on the same concept of the Aryan race, of which Albert Pike was a notorious proponent. So now you have this. This is where white supremacism now comes into the United States, where this Kabbalistic idea of this Aryan race, Gog and Magog, Khazars, supposedly white people who now infiltrate the evangelical movement in the United States, that creates this ongoing base of support. And that base of support has continued to be part of the what's called the Southern Strategy, which was most recently used by Donald Trump. So there's, I don't know if we need to take a break now, but there's so much there in between that can be discussed to explain how that evolves.